Heute zu Gast Michiel Müller, Gründer des holländischen Unicorns Picnic.
And you see in Amersfoort, before we started, the amount of online groceries was 1%. And now it's 5% of the total. And we have 4% of that. So online groceries in these cities is already responsible for 4% of total supermarket sales. So including all the stores. And that is an enormous shift because also in Germany, if bigger, let's say, retail chains in supermarket world get 0.1% extra market share, they call the Frankfurter Allgemeine to say that something had happened.
Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
Kleines Quiz am Anfang. Was haben Waschmaschine, Rasenmäher oder das hier auch schon aus dem Podcast bekannte Kinderspielzeug, die Tony-Box, gemeinsam? Die Antwort heißt Grandcentrics. Grandcentrics ist eine Firma, die all diese Dinge ins Internet der Dinge bringt. Und wer uns regelmäßig hört, der kann sich schon denken, die Firma gehört zu Vodafone, ist eine Tochterfirma von Vodafone und hat eine Kundenliste, quasi das Who is Who des deutschen Mittelstands. Und für all diese Firmen bringt Grandcentrics quasi die Vernetzung und bringt die Produkte ins Internet. Und zwar von der Produktidee bis zur Serienreife, IoT-Lösung jeglicher Art. Wer das Ganze mal online tiefer anschauen möchte, Grandcentrics mit X am Ende, Grand, also grandcentrics.net. Und noch ein Hinweis, von dem ich ziemlich sicher bin, dass den sehr viele hilfreich finden müssten. Es geht um eine Studie, die der Collaborative Marketing Club gemeinsam mit der Deutschen Post gemacht hat. Die machen regelmäßig Studien und untersuchen natürlich, wie Printmailings, also wirklich der Briefträger, wie die Post vom Briefträger, wie die wirkt. Und ich würde es jetzt hier nicht vorlesen, wenn es da nicht auch interessante Ergebnisse gäbe, sonst hätte die Deutsche Post quasi nicht darum gebeten, dass ich es hier vorstelle. Aber die Ergebnisse sind wirklich herausragend. Für ein Euro Porto quasi bekommt man am Ende 10 Euro E-Commerce-Umsatz, wenn man seine Bestandskunden als Online-Händler beschickt. Oder anders formuliert, der Return on Advertising Spend ist in dem Bereich fast 1000% für E-Commerce-Firmen, die ihre Bestandskunden anmelden. Man kann natürlich viel, viel mehr machen. Die Studie umfasst auch viel, viel mehr Kennzahlen. Wer entsprechend mal nachschauen möchte, was man alles machen kann im Bereich klassisches Mailing, und da gibt es wirklich einiges mit erstaunlichen Werten. Ich habe ja gerade schon den krassesten Wert genannt. cmc-studie.de, dort kann man alles runterladen. Oder man kann dem Dirk Görz, das ist der Vice President Dialogmarketing der Deutschen Post, am 18.06. um 9 Uhr bei unserer digitalen Masterclass zuhören. Wir machen ja ohnehin jetzt demnächst im Juni unsere OMR Digital Masterclasses und einer, der dabei spricht, ist der Dirk. Ich glaube, wir werden da generell ein sehr, sehr gutes Produkt hinbekommen. Ich habe das jetzt gesehen, sieht wirklich super aus und freue mich, um 9 Uhr direkt an dem Morgen geht es sofort los mit der Vorstellung der Studienergebnisse. Ich würde mich natürlich freuen, wenn ihr da reinschaut. Ich glaube, die Arbeit hier von CMC und der Deutschen Post ist es wirklich wert. Wir haben uns vorgenommen, den OMR-Podcast nur in Ausnahmefällen auf Englisch zu machen. Immer dann, wenn eine Gästin, ein Gast ja herausragende Sachen macht oder Geschichten zu erzählen hat oder vielleicht irgendwie besonders prominent ist. In der aktuellen Folge ist das gar nicht der Fall. Der Michiel Müller von Picnic ist nicht so bekannt, aber die Firma, die er mitgegründet hat, Picnic halt, halte ich für eines der spannendsten, jetzt schon vermutlich Unicorns in Europa. Man kann hier so in super Zeitlupe, glaube ich, beobachten, wie eine Plattform entsteht, wie man eine Firma ja aus dem kleinen Holland zu wahrscheinlich europäischer Dimension führt, zu einer Bewertung wahrscheinlich in den nächsten Jahren von deutlich jenseits der 10 Milliarden, würde ich wetten, wird sich Picnic entwickeln. Das Modell ist einfach schon bewiesen, sehr, sehr stark. Und der Bereich, in dem sie arbeiten, nämlich der Lebensmitteleinzelhandel, ist halt einfach auch so groß und bietet so viel an. Und jetzt haben sie nach all den Jahren, wo sich da andere die Zähne ausgebissen haben, dieses Feld halt geknackt. Und das ist, finde ich, sehr beeindruckend und sehr beispielhaft. Man lernt davon sehr viel, wenn man einfach mal zuhört, wie das bei ihm passiert ist und wie sie über das ganze Business nachdenken. Ja, in dem Sinne direkt rein in einen englischsprachigen Podcast mit einem wahrscheinlich der besten Unternehmer Hollands und wahrscheinlich auch einem, muss man auch sagen, ja, der besten Unternehmer Europas. In dem Sinne, viel Spaß im Podcast. Today we are speaking with Michiel Müller from Rotterdam. Yes. He is one of the founders of Picnic, and Picnic is, I think, a unicorn by now. Is that correct? Is that official?
It's not official, Philip, but I guess with the couple of rounds that we did, we should be far.
Yeah, so like picnic, I'm not sure. You're not active all across Germany yet. You're, I think, focusing on Western Germany, so not everybody might have heard about picnic before. We get into what picnic exactly does, but you've raised, I think, 350 million in the past years.
Correct.
It's huge. It's probably one of the biggest startup companies coming out of the Netherlands in the past years. And I think, and I talked to a lot of people in the industry, everybody says you have the potential to transform the grocery shopping and the, you know, the way we buy food.
Yes, well, I of course fully agree, Philip. No, but it's definitely a shift that has happened over the last 5 years. Also now since 2 years in Germany, where we started, of course, in Nordrhein-Westfalen. Mm-hmm. And what you see is that the way we deliver groceries makes it possible for everyone to do online groceries. So also the nurse and the policeman and the fireman can now do online groceries. Mm-hmm. And before, it was a sort of a premium product because you had the delivery costs, etc. So we went from a premium market to a mass market. And that means that so many people start to use it. And then you get traction and then you get more brand recognition. And then you're off.
But I mean, like, explain the concept a little bit. I mean, we have like Rewe online, we have all kinds of delivery services. I think almost we have, like, also in Germany, I think there's a very high density of grocery shops, supermarkets, and they're all over the place. I think no country has the same density of supermarkets that Germany has. What's new? I mean, how come you're disrupting this so successfully?
I think Germany and Holland are the same, and it's sort of the same state when we entered the country. So also in Holland, it was sort of a 1% online grocery penetration. And if you compare that to other markets like fashion or electronics or travel, all these markets are on 30, 40 or 50%. And groceries were still lagging behind with a sort of a 1%. So you have 1% on one side and 30% on the other side. Which is remarkable, because why would you like to carry milk and water and toilet paper three times a week to your house? And so basically not do that online, while going to a fashion store is sort of fun. But still people started to do that for 30% of the market. So that was a very strange situation. Mm-hmm. And so we did some interviews, and we understood that there are two things that kept people away from online groceries. First of all, they didn't want to wait 2-3 hours at home for their products to arrive. Because in a grocery setting, you have to be at home. Mm-hmm. In a fashion setting, if Zalando delivers a package, you're not at home, maybe they can drop it at the neighbor. But for groceries, of course, this is not possible, because you have chilled products, you have frozen products. Somebody needs to accept these products right away. So then you're sitting at home 2-3 hours waiting for your milk. So that's not very sexy. So that's one. And the second point was that people just didn't want to pay for delivery, because all the other markets, fashion, electronics, travel, these markets were all broken, were all sort of going online, because the online option was cheaper, or at least the same price as the offline store option. Mm-hmm. And the grocery market worldwide is the only exception. It's the only market where ordering online is more expensive than going to the store, because you have delivery costs. Mm-hmm. So we said, if we can avoid these two problems, so long waiting hours and delivery costs, then we have a chance to break this market. And that's exactly what happened. So we developed a model where we have now all your groceries for the lowest price free to your door. So this is the first time in Western world that it's the same cost of having it delivered at your home as going to the supermarket. Mm-hmm. And that has, of course, really helped us take off.
And what did you do before? I mean, where did you, how come you're like so experienced with the industry? I mean, did you have like knowledge before, or were you just like outside in thinking?
No, we are with four founders, and Frederick and Joris, who came up with the idea, they had a software business. Mm-hmm. So they developed, let's say, software for the bigger web shops worldwide, let's say already 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when they came up with the idea, they approached me and they approached a fourth founder. Mm-hmm. And we sat together and we said, hey, listen, if this is something that we can really make happen, then we have a big chance also in the biggest market there is. Because the grocery market is as big as all the other consumer markets together. Mm-hmm. So half of your free spending money in any household goes to groceries. Mm-hmm. So the opportunities were huge, a very low internet penetration, 1%, and the biggest market there is. So with the four of us, we studied quite a lot, and we made the model sort of work for this. Mm-hmm. We had a first pilot in the summer of 15. And as soon as we saw the pilot results, we said, this is going to be big. So we need to roll out as quickly as we can.
But I understand that what you do differently than other delivery services for fresh foods is the logistics, right? You have like a different, I think what you call the milk run logic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was also the most important thing that we tested in our pilot market, is that if you look at, let's say, traditional home delivery, and then you go to a company and they say, I'd like to get home delivery. And then every day you can pick, let's say, one of the 15 delivery slots. You could say 9 o'clock or 10 or 11, whatever it is. So if you have 15 delivery slots per day, and if you have 6 or 7 days a week, then you get to 80 to 100 delivery slots per week that you can choose from as a customer. So in theory, if you live in a street with 100 houses, then everybody could pick a different slot. So you have to go to that street 100 times that week. And we came across the old model of the milkman. So what did the milkman do? They came once a day, maybe a couple of times per week, but only once a day. And they did exactly the same in terms of service, because they were nice at the door. They brought your heavy stuff. Maybe it was a bit expensive. Maybe the assortment wasn't too big. But we said, if we have that milkman model, very efficient last mile, combine it with technology, then we have sort of a best of both worlds. Then you have really your supermarket in your app, in your pocket, and delivering at your front door. So what it means is that for every street in the cities where we deliver, we have a fixed time slot every day. So on Monday, for your street, it will always be 3 o'clock. And for Tuesday, it will always be 7 o'clock at night. And for Wednesday, always 6 o'clock in the evening. Mm-hmm. So this means that if we drive to a street where we have three deliveries that day, we can do them in one go. And that, of course, is far more efficient than a traditional model that has three deliveries in that street that day, has to come back maybe every 2 hours to do another delivery.
Sounds so simple.
Yeah, it sounds really simple. It's not so easy to do. There's quite a lot of mathematics involved, but it's exactly what we tested in Amersfoort in our first pilot city. We said to these people, listen, we've got a great offer for you, lowest price, free delivery. It's on the minute precise, because we are sort of a bus. Yeah? We stop always at the same time, but you cannot pick your delivery time. You just have to pick a day that suits you, where the time suits you, but you cannot pick per day a different time. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, that's great for me, because I'm always at home at Tuesday at 6 o'clock, because my wife always goes to the gym. Mm-hmm. So I'm at home anyhow. So fine. And if you bring it for free, well, that's even better. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what we tested. And in the beginning, in our pilot city, we only had three delivery slots per street per week. And now we have, of course, every day a delivery slot. And so every household has two or three slots that really suits them well. Mm-hmm. And they can just pick it and then get the service.
Okay. And where do you get the food from? I mean, now you like have revolutionized the way the food is delivered and the logistics a little bit, but I mean, do you buy like the food from the same sources, probably that supermarkets buy the food from, right?
Yeah. So in Holland, you have a group of regional supermarkets that have, let's say, organize themselves in a sort of a buying group. Mm-hmm. So together, they all buy their volume at Coca-Cola or at Nestle or anyone else. So we sort of joined that group. And with that, we were able to buy the A brands and a lot of other products. And of course, next to that, we also have our own buying. So for the meat and for the bread and some vegetables, we start buying ourselves. And that's, of course, growing over time. So yes, of course, you need to have products, but we were able to sort of strike a deal with this buying group. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And the reason why you like started in Western Germany is because the proximity to the Netherlands is very good. So you could like deliver into German cities from your warehouses in the Netherlands?
No. It's a bit more strategic than that, but not a lot more. It's because North Rhine-Westphalia is indeed quite close to Holland. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a two-hour drive, so that at least makes it a bit manageable. Secondly, if you can also see in Holland, before we started in Amsterdam, was sort of maybe the 20th or the 30th city that we opened, because we want to make very clear to everybody that starts to know Picnic that this is not something for Berlin or Amsterdam or London or Paris only. This is for everybody. So it's not like you have to live in a big city and are used to all these apps that help you make your life easier. Now, this is also for the nurse and also for the policeman, because these families with a couple of kids also have busy lives. You don't need to be, let's say, in a very cool place somewhere in a big city to have a busy life. Normal people also have busy lives. So that's exactly what we wanted. Make sure that people understand this is for everybody. And then the third part is, of course, that North Rhine-Westphalia is fairly crowded in a way that there are so many cities on a sort of a similar surface as in Holland, meaning that the Picnic model works in a sort of a city environment. And of course, in North Rhine-Westphalia, you have many places like that.
And what's the planning for the next month to come? Are we going to like roll it out throughout Germany?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started in Neuss, and we gradually moved further down to the Ruhrgebiet. So we're now in Essen and Duisburg and Mönchengladbach and Krefeld. And we just opened our second fulfillment center in Herne. So the first one was in Viersen, second one in Herne. And we're now looking into a third one to even expand further. Mm-hmm. So I think for maybe the next 1 or 2 years, we still be very busy in North Rhine-Westphalia. And gradually, we're also looking at other areas in Germany where we can launch. And the good point about the Picnic model is that you don't have to start on a national scale as of day one, which, of course, would also be very, very difficult to do since we have our last mile very concentrated. Maybe it's good to explain. So what happens is people order online through an app. Mm-hmm. And at 10 o'clock at night, they have to finish their order so they get delivered the next day. And the next day in the morning at 6 or 7, then the suppliers come and deliver their products to our fulfillment center. And in those fulfillment center, we make the baskets. So we collect all the goods for every basket. And then we send these baskets to a local city. And in that city, there's a city hub. And from this city hub, we drive these little milkman tours with our electrical van. So in Herne, we have a fulfillment center that makes all these baskets for people. And then they drive to, let's say, Mönchengladbach or the Krefeld. And then from Krefeld, they drive with these little electrical vans to the people's homes. And so it's just sort of a hub and spoke system.
And those electrical cars that you just mentioned, you develop them for this purpose directly, right?
Yeah. Because if you look at the last mile of any business, you have sort of three key elements that make it difficult and costly. First of all is, how long does it take before you get to your first address? So that's the stem time. Mm-hmm. Then you have the time that it really takes to deliver. So how much time does it take to get the groceries out of your vehicle and deliver it at the front door? And then the third element is the intra drop time. So how much time does it take to go from customer A to customer B? Mm-hmm. Now, since we have such a high density, that last element is basically zero. I mean, our electrical Picnic vehicles, they drive maybe a couple of hundred meters between two customers. So that's a sort of negligible. And so everything comes down to how much time does it actually take to deliver the goods when you're at people at the person's address. And that's something that we optimize with our van. So our vans are not only electrical, but also very small. So most of the time you can park in front of people's homes and other cars can still pass by. Mm-hmm. That, of course, saves time. Otherwise, you have to park at the corner of the street and then you have to walk 2 times 100 meters. That's one. And also these are side. You can open the side with a canvas and you can get the crates out fairly easily. Meaning you don't have to climb inside the vehicle and start looking for your crates. It's all software engineered, software guided. So the runners, our delivery guys and girls, can easily find the crates, bring them to the front door. It has already been paid. So literally in 1 or 2 minutes later, they're back in their little vehicle and drive to the next customer.
And how many?
And that leads to a third of the last mile costs versus the traditional model.
How many vehicles do we have by now across the company?
Today we have about 1,000 vehicles.
And who makes them? Who makes them for you?
Who makes them? Now we buy the electrical part in France, and then we bring them to Holland and Germany, and there we start building sort of the rest of the vehicle in order to have it completely geared towards our way of delivery. And so this is not a vehicle that you can buy on the market. So also that, we've built the software ourselves, of course, we built the warehouse management, the app, etc. But also starting to make a vehicle, especially for the purpose of home delivery, has really given us the, the efficiency that we needed.
Okay, well, I mean, I know this is a tricky question and you might want to dug it a little bit, but I have to throw it at you. What's the revenue structure? How much revenue do you have and how much do you have in Germany?
Yeah, so we've been doubling since we started. So in Holland last year, we finished with 300 million run rate sales. Mm-hmm. And for Germany, we won't be at that point at the end of this year, but definitely we will have doubled since 2019. Mm-hmm. So also there in Germany, it's a matter of opening new cities, because as soon as you open a city, you see that there's enough demand to start opening your city hub and immediately start delivering your first orders. So for us, growing revenue is basically opening new cities. Mm-hmm. And with that, of course, with an important growth, you will always see that the profitability lags behind a bit, because the growth means that you open a new city, you can maybe do 10,000 orders per week in that city, but on day one, you of course have one order. So these city hubs need to grow in volume over time. So it takes 4, 5, 6 months to get to a certain volume. And as soon as you start opening many hubs at the same time, of course, this means that your profitability will shift a bit further down the line. But that's exactly what we want, because we want to grow since the opportunity is there and the profitability will come by itself.
Okay. So, I mean, listening to this, it sounds like you're building here like a multi-billion company, and everybody can watch you do it in slow motion. But the path seems very clear. I mean, it seems like, you know, you're now on a mission, and the path is like very logical, and it takes city by city, and it's probably within Germany, state by state, and then you know, you take the next country. Is that how you envision it for yourself?
Absolutely. And that's nice, because city by city is a lot easier than do a national start. Of course, that would be impossible for our model, because you need all the vehicles, you need all the trained people. It's just impossible to do. So the fact that our model allows it to do it city by city is very powerful. The second thing that is really interesting is that also for, let's say, second tier cities, so not the Berlins and the Londons, it is very, very useful. And there, of course, are many more second-tier cities than the bigger capitals. And thirdly, the fact that we see that this works for all households, so for families, for maybe the people that live by the two of them, or all of it. I mean, all households love Picnic once they start using it. And the loyalty of customers is so high that you can not only predict quite well how many orders you will receive next week, but it also means that your marketing cost is fairly low. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to spend €200 per customer before they buy the first basket. It's just the fact that we are there, the word of mouth, they see this electrical vehicle driving to their neighborhood. So they understand immediately, hey, this is something new, maybe I should give it a try. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so how long does it usually take until like you just set foot into a city and the city has like broken even?
About 6 months. So what happens is after 6 months, you have enough orders to pay, let's say, everything that's related to the city. So the deliveries at the last mile, but also the rent of the local hub, of the local city hub. You've paid for the trunking, yeah, so to get the baskets to that city hub. So everything is paid, inclusive marketing. Mm-hmm. And from 6 months on, you start to contribute to the rest of the costs, which is, of course, the fulfillment, the picking the orders, and a bit of head office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and then your sweet spot is like smaller cities. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, it's not like
not so much smaller, but let's say not only the bigger capitals. So you don't need Berlin, München, and Hamburg only. No, you can do it everywhere. And if you see our biggest city and our fastest growing city is Mönchengladbach, is it a big city? Well, some say it's it's fairly big, but it's the perfect city. Many people live there that work maybe inside town or a bit outside. They have busy lives. They love to have the grocery delivered at home. And it's really easy to do because we have the app. And literally in 2-3 minutes time, you did your groceries and you go on do funny stuff with your life.
And how many people are then like, how many people do you need in a city? I mean, that I understand the timing, but like, is it like a couple hundred households or is it a couple thousand households? How many?
A city hub should be able to reach, let's say, 40,000 households, meaning that a city hub can also reach more neighborhoods, more areas or smaller villages that are close by. But you need about 40,000 households to have sort of a logical minimum to start a city hub. So this doesn't work for, let's say, the countryside. If you would go to areas in Germany or in Holland where just not too many people live, it won't work because you can't do it for free because your density will never be sufficient.
But I mean, you need like cities with 40,000, and how many active customers do you need to have there to that works? I mean, not all 40,000 will then be.
Now, if you see what we always call our oldest city is now Amersfoort. This is sort of nearly 4.5 years, and you see in Amersfoort before we started. The amount of online groceries was 1%, and now it's 5% of the total, and we have 4% of that. So online groceries in these cities is already, our part is already responsible for 4% of total supermarket sales, so including all the stores. And that is an enormous shift because also in Germany, if bigger let's say retail chains in supermarket world get 0.1% extra market share. They call the Frankfurter Allgemeine to say that something had happened. So if you win 4% in a couple of years' time, this is, of course, a huge shift in demand. And this will not stop because also in Amersfoort, our oldest city, we still have double-digit growth. So this can basically go on for a long, long time. And if we read, let's say, the magazines and the newspapers about this market, then some say this will grow to 10 or 20 or 30%. But why not? Why would you spend more time online for buying fashion than for buying, let's say, the more boring stuff like milk and apples and onions and bread, if the quality is exactly the same as you would find in a store?
Ganz frisch im Podcast der Hinweis auf die Oracle Cloud CX, also die Marketing Cloud von Oracle. CX heißt Customer Experience und das wird wahrscheinlich den wenigsten so klar sein, was sich hinter dieser Marketing Cloud von Oracle so alles verbirgt. Denn die Kollegen haben in den letzten Jahren einige Firmen übernommen, unter anderem Eloqua für B2B E-Mail-Automatisierung, Responses zur Steuerung von B2C Cross-Channel Marketing Kampagnen oder Maximizer für AB-Testing und Website-Personalisierung. All diese Services sind alle Teil der Oracle Cloud, ein extrem mächtiges Tool. Wer mal mehr über das Tool hören möchte und vor allen Dingen auch Cases sehen möchte, wer anfassbar verstehen möchte, wie Customer Experience Management heute funktioniert, dem sei die Oracle Masterclass im Rahmen unserer digitalen Masterclass am 17. und 18. Juni ans Herz gelegt. Wir haben da relativ stark darauf geachtet, dass da auch anfassbare Beispiele sind, wo man wirklich sehen kann, okay, wenn man ein größeres Marketingbudget hat, dann kann man solche Sachen machen, wie halt eben mit der Oracle Cloud CX. Schaut mal rein und denkt beim nächsten Marketing Cloud Shopping an Oracle. Okay, and so like in true revenues, what do you predict? I mean, I'm sure you're doing business planning for the company. What do you think, like maybe like, let's say 2022, 2021, you think it's probably going to be a $1 billion company in terms of revenue, correct?
22 maybe, yeah. If you add Holland and Germany together, it all depends on the speed that we can find cities and open city hubs. That's exactly the whole point. And so we're now looking at the third fulfillment center in Germany. And that will, of course, again, create a lot of capacity. And now we also see with Corona, of course, that more and more people want to understand, how does this work? Can I have my product delivered at home? So this is also an enormous push for the demand. And what we see is that the people that tried for the first time, maybe because of Corona, of course, they start to understand, hey, is this something for me? Yes or no? So this will also help, let's say, in the longer term, and that's not only true for our market, but for all online markets, help the online penetration.
Okay, but I understand that like maybe Corona came like a little too early for you. Maybe 2 years further down the road, it would have probably been even more helpful for you to have Corona, I assume.
Yeah, if you would have more markets open, of course. So, but still, I mean, I think if you look at Germany and the cities that we open, what you see always happening. So people get to understand, hey, Picnic is coming to Krefeld. Then they also already start downloading the app. So before we have delivered the first banana, people are already lining up in our app. And this is something that we did since the beginning, because what happened is when we launched in Holland, we had 4 electrical vehicles. And on day one, when we opened up and we got quite a lot of press, then we had 5,000 families signing up. So, of course, 4 vehicles and 5,000 families, that won't work. So overnight, we built a waiting list. So we said to people, well, sorry. You have to be on a waiting list for a couple of weeks, because we have to build new vehicles to get all these groceries to your homes. And that system of a waiting list has been there ever since, because with that you can sort of manage the demand that is quite substantial and deliver the correct service. So this means that if we have 10 vehicles, but we can do X amount of customers. If we have 20 vehicles, we can do 2X. And that's really nice, because that means that people maybe have to wait a couple of weeks on the waiting list, but at least they get the perfect service once they get in. Because then there is capacity for them. They can always order. They get the best products, very fresh. There's no food waste in the system. So this is everything that they wanted. And so waiting a couple of weeks is most of the time worthwhile.
And it creates scarcity, right? I mean, it creates the desire of the people to, like, you know, be part of it, because it's you know, waiting and limiting the access usually, you know, increases the wish to be part of it, right?
Yeah, but we did indeed get a couple of marketing prizes for this waiting list feature. But this has been something that was just created by accident, but also by necessity on day one, because we just had too much demand. And the other thing is, if you look at Mönchengladbach, say that you can do whatever, 10,000 deliveries per week. And if you start on day one with a capacity of 10,000 deliveries per week, you need to have 1,000 vehicles and 1,000 runners, so delivery boys and girls, etc., on day one. And we say, hey, let's start with 10, and then we increase it by 20 the next month, and then we go to 40 2 months later. And in that way, you can increase capacity and immediately have the demand to match it, which is, of course, far more efficient, and you can also start earlier. Because having 100 vehicles also means that you have to train 300 runners, 300 delivery people.
You say that like when you go to a city, there's word of mouth and there's almost immediate demand. But how do you trigger that? How do you get like the message out? I mean, I understand there's your vehicles driving around, but this sounds too easy. I mean, you have to like really drive people's attention and get the attention. What do you do beyond that?
Yeah, we have we do a couple of things. Of course, we do a bit of online advertising. Mm-hmm. So Google Ads, we do Facebook, we do member get member. So people that have Picnic in other cities, they start posting online. Hey, if you would like to use Picnic in Bochum, then use this code and you get a bit of discount, and I also get a bit. So it's also online word of mouth, and then as soon as we start driving, people start noticing these vehicles, and since we drive in a neighborhood in a certain hour because of this Milkman model. So for instance, we go to Krefeld and we drive to a certain area, we go there with 10 vehicles. So if you are in that area at that point in time when Picnic is delivering, you see a lot of vehicles drive around. So it really, let's say, catches your attention. And that means that you start looking for this brand, what are they doing? Then you hear your neighbor talking about it. So it's also a lot of, let's say, stable growth because of that. And that helps enormously because the marketing cost is really very low. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that you don't do any like out of home advertising, you don't sponsor something, you do a lot of PR in the regional press, I believe, right?
Yeah, we do. Sometimes we do something with the local football club, or we're now starting in Düsseldorf and we do something with the food bank. Mm-hmm. And we do something with local entrepreneurs, but it's all very local, and that's something that we would love to keep. Mm-hmm. Is that Picnic is really something for your neighborhood. It's your Picnic coming to Mönchengladbach or to Krefeld or to Bochum. It's not this big American brand coming to your country. No, we are local. The people that drive our little vans are also local people. And so it's sort of something that comes to your place, and it really reminds you of the milkman, the kind person that helps you with your groceries.
And is this Picnic, the name, mean the same in Dutch as it means in German? Do you know that?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah, as in English.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why you found it, right? I mean, it's Picnic. It's like you go out and with friends and sit in some field.
We were looking for a name that needed to fit into a square logo, because if you go online, very long names are not very helpful. If you have an app, you need to have a square logo. And we needed to find something that people could remember, but also sort of gave them the impression, hey, this is something about fun, sitting on a in the park with my family, having something to eat, and then picking the groceries at the same time. Sort of that sort of happy feeling about the name.
And you try to make it more, I think you try to build my perception, at least, or what I hear, is that you try to build the brand like almost into a love brand, not only the name, but also like, I think before the first purchase, there's already a banana in your basket and these kind of things. Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. That we call Wachtespaß. So if you have to wait on the waiting list for a couple of weeks, that's not very nice. So we say to you, listen, you've got to wait because we're now building a couple of new vans so we can let you in. But please, we have something in your basket every week for free. So bananas or milk or whatever it is. And then as soon as you order your first order, these products will be in your first basket for free.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other... any other gimmicks or like features like that you came up with, like the waiting list, the milk run, the Wartespaß, any other like the local approach, the love brand approach, anything else that you think is very like important to the model?
No, I think definitely. I think that the fact that we have been really, really very strict on having this 3 minute maximum time that you need to order. So that's why we also started only with an app. So you cannot download it on desktop or something. So you only have an app. And this means that when you're in public transport or you're waiting somewhere for a bus to arrive or whatever it is, you can do your groceries everywhere. And that's also what you see. And that's also something we introduced, a sort of a family account. So more people of the same family can order in the same basket. And this is, of course, also funny because now the son of 16 years old doesn't complain to his parents, hey, my toothpaste is out of stock. No, they say you should have ordered it. So it's also a way of sort of creating the family experience inside the app. And we are improving every day. We're changing navigation. We're working on the photography. We're working on, let's say, the way we describe the articles. And I think that's very powerful in the Picnic as a company, is that since we built all the software ourselves, like we talked about, we also even build our own vehicles. This means that every day we can improve it with 0.5%. Because if we have an idea, we can implement it, test it, and if it works, we just roll it out. And that is very powerful, because that means that over time, you get more and more features inside. You make the product better every day. And this is, of course, something that is typical maybe for a tech company. But in the market where we are, there are so many traditional companies that are having the market share and the power in that market. It's difficult for them to replicate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. How old are you? How old is the team? I mean, it sounds like you could be doing this like Jeff Bezos for the next 20, 30 years.
No, the founders are extremely old because they're all 50. And our average age is 27. So this is, of course, a huge problem for us as older founders, because so when there's a Friday drink at the bar, we just have to compensate by drinking that extra beer.
What did you do before? I mean, understand that two of your co-founders had like a software company. But what did you do?
I was an entrepreneur before this, so I had two other companies where I was involved in. One was a chain of unmanned service stations, so selling gasoline and diesel to car owners.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was a road assistance company. So in Germany, of course, you have ADAC.
Mm-hmm.
And in Holland, you have ANWB, sort of similar companies, sort of monopolists. And we put a competitor to them in the market. And those two companies have similarities with Picnic, because basically what you see is that you have a market that is quite well organized. And you have a couple of big companies that sort of divide the market. And maybe the level of innovation is not that high. And then you have a young company with a white sheet of paper saying, okay, let's do everything completely new with the newest technology, with the latest insights on customer behavior and globalization, etc. How would that market look like now? And that's exactly what we did with Picnic, just completely redesigned it. You want to get groceries at home. With all the technologies there that is there today, how can you make that more easily than go to the supermarket yourself? And that's the same that happened to the other markets where I was launching a brand in. Is now also happening with Picnic.
But it sounds like, I mean, those were two big markets that you operated in and that you built the companies in, and then you sold them. So it sounds like before you started Picnic, you would have had the option to just lay on the beach until you die.
Yeah. Yeah, this doesn't sound too interesting, does it?
No. I mean, I would also argue building Picnic is a better thing to do, but it sounds like you were like already like you got rid of the most concerning troubles in life and the most need to worry that much anymore.
I think the after we sold our second company, we also invested quite a lot in young startups, so always internet space startups, and we love doing it, but I missed a bit the dynamism of doing it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So when Joris and Frederik gave me a call and talked about their plans, I said, well, listen, guys, this is exactly what I'm looking for, to really again jump into this deep swimming pool and try and see if we can make this happen. And since this was not only a very good idea, but also a huge market, This has created so many challenges, and I would always say so far so good. We've managed to do quite a lot of the things that we've planned for, and that's also something very nice when you start a new business. There's so many companies coming your way since you come into a new area, and there you see creating partnerships is very valuable.
Who's more of a competitor to you in the future, the supermarket chains or Amazon Fresh or Amazon in general?
No, I wouldn't say Amazon in general, but in general, technology companies are, of course, a competitor that's more difficult to fight, because the traditional supermarkets, they have their own real estate, they have all their rental contracts, they have all the structure in place to do offline groceries, and they're very successful. It's a fantastic model, but switching from stores to online is not easy to do and will take many, many, many years for them. So if there's somebody else that has a more tech background and understands technology and also maybe is looking at new ways of doing this, that could probably be a bigger competitor. Now, for Amazon specifically, Amazon, of course, has been trying with Amazon Fresh now for quite a long while. So far, not with a lot of success. And this relates a bit to the fact that they are used to ship parcels. So you buy something, electronic device, and then they ship it to you. That's fairly easy because you can use the FedEx and the DHL type of networks. But for groceries, it's completely different. I mean, you can try and send via DHL your fresh pizzas, etc. But it's not easy. The network is not made for it. So either your service level is too low, maybe the quality of the product is not good. The packaging will be enormous just to keep it cool and keep it unscratched. So it's not easy for them. And now you also see them pulling out of a couple of markets in the US. So groceries and parcels is just a different world. But of course, we won't be the only one who's going to try this.
I mean, do you look at German companies such as Flash & Post or Durst Express and these kind of companies?
Yeah, I think also Flash & Post has more a tech background. If you look at Bofrost, that has also been there for a long, long time. Sort of a niche product range, but apparently they're still there. Flash & Post is more like a bit more technology driven, but those are the companies that are also creating their own market. And groceries, of course, is difficult because you have fresh products, you have three temperature zones, and to do that the way we do it, on the minute precise and free delivery, that's fairly big challenge to copy that. So, of course, some people will try, which is great, because more market going online is always good. But it's not easy to do if you don't have a good plan and a proper tech team.
And do you think that Amazon Fresh might not even be around in the next couple of years?
I wouldn't be too surprised if they would keep on struggling with this. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the sustainability part of our business, the way we structured Picnic with the Elektrofahrzeuge, with the zero food waste, because we only order the products with our suppliers if we know somebody has bought them. So we have no food waste, which is, of course, in the retail supply chain, a big issue. And if you also see that we do on-the-minute precise with very complete baskets, this is something that's not so easy to do. And I think Amazon Fresh or Amazon has maybe other opportunities or other markets that they are better at to focus on. So I'm not too sure if they will put everything on fresh groceries.
What do you think about those classic supermarkets? I mean, there's chains behind them mostly, and the structure is different. I mean, mostly those markets are owned by a local hero who has like two or three markets. But so does that model keep them from really competing with you?
No, I think the fact that you use the term local hero, I like that very much, because in retail, in the store world, all local heroes will survive. Of course, online is not going to be 100% of the market. Supermarkets will always be there. Fashion stores will always be there because it serves a purpose. But you need to be a local hero and really care for your customers and really deliver great products. Then you're safe. But if you have a sort of a B quality operation over the last 10 or 20 years, well, you didn't matter too much because you had a very profitable model. It didn't take too much effort. And so the business was going by itself. Then you are, or you could be in trouble once the internet or tech companies hit your market, because then you're not ready. And then customers will just try something else because you haven't served them the quality that they needed.
Man weiß ja, dass Deutschland zahlreiche Weltmarktführer hervorgebracht hat in der Automobilindustrie, im Mittelstand. Aber was man nicht so im Blick hat, zumindest geht es mir so, ist, dass auch in der größten Branche, die es überhaupt gibt auf der Welt, nämlich der Lebensmitteleinzelhandel, der Marktführer aus Deutschland kommt. Die Rede ist von Aldi und die sitzen sogar oder sind gegründet worden in Essen, in meiner Heimatstadt, und sitzen mittlerweile in Mülheim, also direkt um die Ecke. Man kann dort extrem gut leben und arbeiten. Und das könnte passend sein für euch, denn die Kollegen bei Aldi Süd suchen Unterstützung. Und wer hier zuhört und sich auskennt mit Themen wie Customer Interaction, wie Implementierung einer neuen Digitallandschaft rund um Adobe, Salesforce, SAP, der wird dort gesucht. Also IT-Experten, digitale Projektmanager, all diese Jobprofile werden händeringend in Mülheim gesucht. Es geht um eine der spannendsten Firmen dieses Landes, eine der erfolgreichsten auf jeden Fall. Alle Jobs, die da offen sind, stehen unter itjobsohnebugs.com, also itjobsohnebugs mit bugs.com, in einem Wort geschrieben. Informiert euch, wer Lust hat, nach Essen, nach Mülheim. Ich gebe gerne Tipps zur Ansiedlung, wo man da gut wohnen kann, wen man da gut treffen kann. Eine tolle Region und ich glaube Aldi, eine Firma, die uns weltweit im Spiel hält. Do you have a lot of churn? I mean, like people that have used Picnic, are they like all staying with it? Or is there people like that try and do it for half a year and then go back? I mean, I would believe, you know, you never, once you've on it, you never go back. But is that true?
The fact that your example of people using it for 6 months and then going away, we do not have. So what happens is we have three very important moments in the life of a Picnic customer. First, of course, is the first order. So you put yourself to it, you download the app and you try it for the first time. Then the second order. So apparently the first time was okay. And then we go to the fifth or the sixth order, because if you're still there and you have done six orders, you will never go away again. And that's something that you can see in our charts. So if you look at the numbers and at the charts, you see that people, of course, they try it and maybe somebody says, well, I don't like it, or it doesn't fit my schedule, or whatever it is. But as soon as you've tried it for 5-6 times, you start to understand the app very well. You start to understand how the milkman run is. You see that the Tuesday is always a perfect day for you. Then you get into this habit creation mode and you just never go away again. And this is really important, because we see with the, let's say, the cities that are now 4 or 5 years with us, that you see the first customers are still there. That first chunk that use it for a couple of times is still there. So over time, you build layer after layer a very loyal group. So you will never see somebody leaving after 6 months. Yeah, maybe because they move to a city where we don't deliver, but they always stay around. And that's very powerful, because then you know exactly what to expect. You can do your capacity planning on that, and you also have your, let's say, your plans for the future, you can base on that, because your customer base is very, very solid.
And do you like do something specific from a marketing perspective, from a customer care perspective, within like at those 1, 2, 5 touch points, where you like make sure that those touch points or that those deliveries are really working out the best possible, since they're so important?
Yeah. So what we did in the beginning, also when we launched in Germany, we had a couple of months of testing. So we didn't use the Picnic brand, we used the Sprinter brand, or sort of white vehicles. And then we invited people and families to come to a hotel or to a restaurant to talk with us and to become our pilot customers. And what we wanted to do is to understand, how do customers react to this? What would they like to see in the app? Do they understand the app? What are their questions? And then you get to a lot of things that you can improve upon, maybe the way you collect deposit, your empty bottles, etc., the way you use the bags, the way you allow for payments. So you make something that customers really want and understand. And that's something that we've been doing so far. So as soon as you have a problem with your product, you get to an agent via maybe the app itself, or you can give them a call or send them an email. Well, most people just use the app to also communicate with our customer success department. And it's solved right away. Even our runners, our delivery guys and girls at the door, they are trained to solve an issue immediately while standing at the door. So if somebody says, hey, I didn't order a cucumber, I see a cucumber in my basket, then they immediately credit the person. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, extremely powerful, especially in the beginning when this is all very new. You just want to understand how this works. And we're now introducing something really cool that in the app, after you had your delivery and the runner is already off to his second customer, and you find something that maybe is a problem, or you got two products instead of one, or whatever it is, then you can immediately in the app organize it yourself. So you don't have to app somebody or call somebody or mail somebody. It's just you can do it yourself. So if you say, hey, this banana, I didn't like it because it was too green or too brown or whatever it is, you just swipe it and you get your money back.
Okay. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Isn't that too risky that people will be like, cheating you?
No. My experience is, and I guess also yours, is that 99.99% of the people can be trusted.
Okay.
And if you talk about a love brand, or at least a brand that is very helpful and helps you and takes you seriously, it's not a brand that you're going to cheat for one banana.
Okay. Okay.
And also, this is also where data, of course, comes in, because if you see that a certain person always has troubles with his banana and nobody else in the street, something must be wrong. Yeah. Maybe we should get a better understanding what the perfect banana for this person is.
Like you mentioned the app quite a bit, and you said a couple of minutes ago that people that you have made the conscious decision not to have a website that people can order from. I mean, yeah. I imagine like the discussion like I would have in many other companies, people would say, look, not having a website to order from is killing conversion. It's reducing our potential. You must have had the same discussion. And then you said, look, I'm willing to sacrifice all these revenues and all these orders that we don't get just in order to have the app.
Yeah, of course. In the beginning, we said, hey, listen, we need an app for sure. And then we will make the desktop a bit later. But when we saw that so many people, also, let's say, not the people of 25, but a bit older, were using the app so easily, we thought that we should not open a desktop version, because now 100% of our customers are on mobile. So we now have app-only supermarket. Well, most companies, of course, they report to their shareholders or to their stakeholders that, listen, we now have 40% via mobile. We have 100%. So it's a perfect situation. You only have to develop on one platform. You only have to maintain one platform. And people always have their grocery list in their pocket because their telephone is always nearby. So if they think, I shouldn't forget to buy peanut butter, so they just put it in the app and then they go on with their lives. So this has brought so much to us that we will never, ever open up a desktop version. Although maybe it will generate 5 or 10% extra volume now, but in the end, it's not a good idea.
Okay. Okay. Who are your investors? Who are the people that gave you money over the years?
Yeah. So, of course, in the beginning, we as founders invested, and then from around 1, 2, and 3, we have a couple of family offices in Holland. So the bigger entrepreneurial families that have been there for 50 to 100 years. Mm-hmm. And they are our investors in our company. And this is very nice because they have a long-term vision. They're not here for the quick buck. And they also add value to our strategic thoughts. They understand business. They have their own businesses from their own families. So that's really something, a group that we treasure. And that works really well so far. And every time when we had a new growth story and we needed maybe a bit of financing, they joined, the same group joined to deliver the financing.
So there's no US private equity or venture capital or anything?
Nothing.
But I'm assuming they call you all the time and would like to be in the cap table.
Yeah, and of course, and we are very open. So we do invite people to come over and have a talk, and we'd love to explain what we're trying to do. And it is interesting to understand how they are looking at it. But so far, we said in this phase, when we are still growing, where we're still developing new markets, it is very valuable to have the same investors on board and create the trust for them also to keep investing. And so far, they've been doing so. And so in the last round of September last year, we did a 250 million round to invest, among other things, in a automated fulfillment center. So that's where we will drive technology and automation a lot further than today, and building an automated fulfillment center, which means, of course, more efficiency, but also more capacity. So more orders can come out of this center. But this is new technology, and they invested in that because they now are sort of, let's say, confident that we as a team and the tech team can deliver these difficult products. And so they're more than happy to invest.
And you have, like, across the whole company, you have like almost 1,000 people now working for you, right?
In Holland, a bit more than 5,000, and in Germany, yes, about 1,000.
Okay, so altogether, yeah. It's 6,000 and
yeah.
Almost. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then you invested a couple of millions yourself?
Yeah, so all the founders, of course, spent time and money. And then we did a Series A when we launched, so the first city. And then I think it was February 17, so that was a bit less than 2 years later, we did a 100 million round. And then again, a bit more than 2 years later, we did the 250 round.
Okay. So, but you still own like double-digit shares of the company?
Yes, absolutely.
Whoa, I mean, that's quite helpful.
Yeah, with the four of us.
Okay.
Yeah. So what we did is we managed to also convince our shareholders, to our investors, to understand that this is not something that you will start on Friday afternoon and close on Monday morning. This is a 10-year business plan with an enormous potential. Mm. And if we're able to deliver on all these milestones, then they know what's coming. So there's a lot of let's say benefits still coming our way as long as we keep on hitting those milestones. And so far, so good.
Can you imagine going IPO anytime soon?
Yeah, no, soon, not soon, but sure. I mean, why not? I mean, we're not looking at it at all. Mm. We're happy with the way it is. There's still so many things that we can do. If you look at the model itself that we improve every time, but also the whole supply chain before products get to our fulfillment centers. So in terms of packaging, in terms of efficiencies, in terms of the way you can work together with suppliers, I mean, there's still so much more to discover that we love doing this for quite a while still.
All right. Whoa. Interesting story. I mean, it's probably like one of the next major unicorns coming out of Europe, I would assume. If not already, I mean, maybe it's a unicorn already. I assume it's going to grow. A unicorn a couple of times over in the next years. I'm really happy you took the time and told us about it, even though many listeners might not even have the chance to use the service yet, but they will soon.
Absolutely.
You know, it might be fun for everybody listening to follow your journey and see how you're building it. And I would personally bet that this is a story that is going to be around for a long time. And it's fun to watch you guys grow. So thank you very much for joining.
Well, thanks a lot, Philip, and really nice that Omar took the time also to dig into this one. And we're more than happy to share a bit more down the line.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye bye.
Ciao. Bye bye.
Wer hier zuhört und noch im Studienalter ist oder zumindest im erweiterten Studienalter, für den habe ich noch was, und zwar ein Hinweis auf den MBA in Digital- und Medienmanagement an der Hamburg Media School. Also ein Masterstudiengang in Vollzeit, gibt es auch in Teilzeit, glaube ich. Alle Infos dazu, hamburgmediaschool.com. Übrigens, ich kann nur empfehlen, wer darüber nachdenkt, wer Lust hat, so ein Studium anzufangen, informiert euch auch persönlich. Da gibt es meine Kollegin, die Friederike Wettengel, und die kann wirklich sehr sympathisch und sehr kompetent Auskunft geben. Es geht noch bis zum 15. Juli, sich zu bewerben und dann im Oktober vielleicht schon anzufangen. Also in dem Sinne, hamburgmediaschool.com.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.